It's my pleasure to introduce you to our speakers today. We have Hugh Miller, Principal at Taylor Fry and our 2021 Actuary of the Year, and Jason Gu, Manager at Taylor Fry, to present their session, Network, Exploring the Net Costs and Benefits of the NDIS. And as I welcome Hugh and Jason up here to speak, I'd just like to remind you that you can ask questions via the Q&A icon on the IDSS app. There's a link to download in your pass. And yes, we'd encourage you to ask as many questions as you can. Thank you so much and welcome Hugh and Jason.
Thanks so much for coming along, everybody. Thanks so much, Jess. And I just want to acknowledge that the NDIA and Jess specifically sort of helped with data provision and some of our work for this. So you can't do any of these things without data. So that was very, very helpful in what was quite a rapid sort of project. So if that works, yeah, that's good. So I'll give a bit of an introduction to the NDIS review, and then we'll sort of talk about the main game, which is about the net costs and the net benefits. There is a third topic. We'll get there if we have time. So by way of introduction, most people here might be familiar with the NDIS review. It was commissioned at the end of 2022 by Bill Shorten, ran over 2023. So it ran over a year. Which is a long time until you sort of realise the amount of work that got done within that, and it's actually quite a rapid review in many ways. And so it had an independent panel. So the picture there is sort of Bill Shorten with the independent panel and the two chairs, Bruce and Lisa. And it was a pretty large consultation process as well. So they sort of talked to 10,000 people. As part of that consultation, had 4,000 submissions. We're trying to address a pretty broad set of terms of references around the participant experience, rebuilding trust, sustainability, effectiveness, quite broad. And if you download the NDIS review report itself, you'll see that it is quite big and broad as well. So 29 major recommendations, and within that 136 action points. So it was an independent sort of panel in charge of it. There's a lot of support that happens behind the scenes. So there was a big team at DPMC, Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, that sort of came together to support the review, and there was a lot of analysis and good work that happened there. And then lots of other bits and pieces, including a lot of support from the NDIA in terms of sort of allowing that all to happen. This talk isn't about that, which might be a shame. But it's about sort of the piece of work we did for the NDIS review. They commissioned a few different projects. Our one had the following scope. So we were asked to say, what were the net costs of the NDIS? And so the word net there is important. So it's about comparing that to what would have happened if there was no NDIS. So basically the existing legacy schemes had continued and what that would have looked like. The second question was, what are the net benefits of the NDIS? And again, the word net is important because it's about the incremental improvements that you can measure in the scheme compared to that sort of counterfactual of the legacy programs. And there was a third thing that we probably won't talk as much about today, which was that if you were to design a measurement framework going forward, what would you do? And so sort of that idea of measuring outcomes, I guess sort of ties into what we'll talk about today, because you'll hear more than once that we didn't have all the data that we would have liked to do. So we did this paper with a partner, CIE, so Economics Consultancy, helped us with some of those economic sort of concepts a little bit. And the report is available online. So if you like reading long reports, have trouble sleeping at night, those sorts of things, it's there to download. If you do download the report, you'll notice that there's about 700 pages of caveats at the beginning. And that was important, particularly as we get to the next slide and the chart on that. It was a relatively tight timeframe, which means that some types of analysis we weren't able to do that would have been nice. There are some challenges associated with estimating costs. So I guess the whole point while the NDIS was rolled out was because there were quite large deficiencies in legacy schemes. So trying to compare it against legacy schemes is a little bit unfair because it was inevitable that things would have had to change given that the system was under a fair amount of strain. And another thing that Jason will touch on in terms of substitution is that our focus was mainly around government. And so we weren't able to see a lot of the private spending, a lot of the NGO spending that existed in the scheme, in disability support, back before the NDIS was a thing. And so there's quite a few things that we can't see. In terms of estimating benefits, we recognise that there are lots of things we can't measure. A lot of benefits are still to materialise. So if you think about the types of benefits we want to see, for example, with kids, they take many years to actually sort of be to manifest. And there's a list there of some of the specific things that would have been nice, but we didn't necessarily get to. So certainly when you think about how the NDIS supports people to have better outcomes in justice and child protection, that's something we can't really see. Similarly, if you want to think about the benefits to community of having a more inclusive society, that's something we weren't able to say a huge amount on either. So with our 700 pages of caveats out of the way, this is sort of the big picture of where we landed. So you can see there that we were working with the 2022-23 financial year. So in that year, NDIS cost for about $35 billion. It's gone up a little bit since then on top of that. And of that 35, we estimated that about $16 billion was sort of net cost. And so that means that $17 billion related to legacy schemes and a couple of billion related to offsets. And Jason will sort of talk about that in a second. On the benefit side, we found net benefits of $7 billion. And then we've got a Weasley sort of shaded grey bar that you can see there just to try and acknowledge the fact that there are lots of things we weren't able to do. And so when we talk about measured benefits, we were relying on things that we concretely could measure an improvement on, if that makes sense. Cool. So that's the big picture, and we'll sort of unpack that over the rest of this session. Before we get into the cost side, it's probably just worth reminding people about the NDIS population. So in March 2023, it looked like this. It's continued to grow. It's in the 700s now rather than the 500s in terms of thousands of participants. But we have quite a mix, and I think that's the thing I want to emphasise on this slide, is that you can see some big categories. So there's a lot of kids with autism, a lot of kids with delay in the scheme. But putting even those to the side, there are a lot of people with a lot of different primary disabilities, as recorded in the NDIS data. And even within a disability type, there's a lot of different categories. So you can see these are the NDIA severity sort of bands that they use for some of their budget models. You don't need to take them too literally, but there is a great gradation across things like intellectual disability, psychosocial disability, even things like acquired brain injury can be relatively mild to quite severe. And that's quite important when you're trying to think about costs and benefits. Because if you're not tailoring your model or your approach to allow for those sorts of differences, it can be quite hard to see what you need to see. So I think that's me done for round one. I'll hand over to Jason for round two.
Thank you. So in order to form a view of the net costs, we first need to start from getting an understanding of the supports that existed before the NDIS for people with disabilities. We refer to this as the legacy scheme, and we project this forward in order to get a counterfactual estimate, which is the cost of legacy schemes in a world where the NDIS was not introduced and they had continued. So we performed a literature review to understand the types of spending that were in place before the NDIS, and we really leaned on the Productivity Commission's Disability Care and Support as a key source because they did the initial gross and net cost estimates back in 2011 before the introduction of the NDIS. Legacy costs were broadly spread into two groups, so those under the National Disability Agreement, which were the majority, and a bucket that sits outside of it. And under the NDA, we had spending such as accommodation support to help people stay in their homes for a bit longer or to move to more appropriate accommodation. There was also community support to help people stay outside of institutional settings, community access to encourage independence, and a couple more. Most of these costs were in the report on government services, also by the Productivity Commission. The main adjustment that we made was around the eligibility around age 65. So they were all included in those report on government services estimates. But in the NDIS, only those who are in the scheme before 65 are able to continue and are eligible for benefits after they turn 65. So after all this, we found that the growth rate for this bucket was around 7%. The other bucket for those outside of the National Disability Agreement, a couple of the things this comprised include home and community care, which later became known as basic community care. This provides support services to help people live independently at home. And a couple of the other big ones are your psychiatric disability community supports, which are your psychosocial supports, and also Australian Disability Enterprises, which help people with significant disabilities have employment opportunities. Publicly available information on this was pretty sparse, so we did have to lean quite heavily on the Productivity Commission's original work, but we did update it with information, the latest information available from state and territory government submissions, plus the NDIS review research team. So putting this all together, we get the light blue line in the chart to the right, which shows that projection of legacy costs past 2016-17 into the future. And rather than us adding our own estimate of NDIS costs to the mix, we just took the latest federal budget figures available to us at the time, the 23-24 budget. And with the benefit of hindsight, we find that in the latest 24-25 period, that aligns pretty well at about $46 billion. And so putting these two things together, we get a picture of the net costs. We'll put substitution's effects aside for now, but the area between the purple and the light blue lines are our net costs. And because of the trajectory of NDIS costs, growing faster than your legacy costs, we have that growing and expanding purple region. And there are a few reasons for this, including plan growth, growth in participant numbers, and also a bit of demographic change, as there's a bigger proportion of people aged over 65 in the scheme. In this slide, we talk about the differences in coverage and support levels in the NDIS compared to legacy schemes. So in the first row, if I direct your attention there, the ratio of the total cost under legacy schemes compared to the NDIS is 49%. And so basically we're saying that the NDIS covers that twice as much is spent on services in the NDIS compared to a hypothetical legacy scheme. And in the second row, the main explanation for this is that the NDIS supports a lot more participants. So we find that 46% of people who are from the legacy cohort are supported in the NDIS. And so there are a lot more people covered by the NDIS. At face value, the average cost per participant is about the same, slightly higher in the projected legacy scheme. But if we've drilled down into the cohort of people who were in those legacy schemes and look at their average cost in the NDIS, we find that it's a lot higher, so $101,000 versus $63,000. And so putting all this together, this means that the NDIS is covering more participants than before in our legacy scenario, but the new participants tend to have lower needs and require less supports. For the participants that would have been in the legacy schemes, we find that on average, the NDIS is providing more supports. Luckily, we have some NDIS unit record data to play with, and we were able to perform a similar analysis across disability segments. So in this next slide, we get to see a breakdown of gross NDIS costs into primary disability and level of function. This is shown in pink, and level of function is highest on the left in each group, so that more severe and profound disability tends to the right in each segment. The ratio of legacy scheme costs to NDIS costs are shown in blue, and the connected segments correspond to the same primary disability group. So the way to interpret this chart is that those points that are closer to one indicate that the legacy scheme and NDIS resemble each other more closely. So the main observation in this chart is that if you look at each of those segments within the same primary disability group, you tend to have an increasing curve. So it's true for those people with most profound and severe disabilities that the coverage in the NDIS was closer to that of the legacy schemes. And this also means that high level of function, people with high levels of function have more expanded coverage under the NDIS compared to before. The second observation is that there are relative funding increases for certain disability groups, so those that lay closer to the bottom of the chart. You've got delay, you've got psychosocial and stroke. Under the NDIS, coverage expanded quite a lot. So, for example, in delay, for the highest level of function, that expanded by about 14, 15 times compared to before. And moving on to substitution estimates, we estimated a total of $2.2 billion, which accounts for where NDIS spending reduced or replaced previous government spending on disability. There are some caveats with this estimate. Importantly, we don't attempt to estimate where substitution occurs outside of government spending, like you mentioned before. It's quite hard to kind of measure the amount of private spending and charitable or non-government organisation spending that would have taken place had it not been for the NDIS kind of picking up those kind of supports. And we think this is probably a kind of substantial number that we're missing out on, but it won't fully kind of fill up the gap that we had between the gross NDIS costs and legacy scheme. Another caveat, which is more applicable to NDIS costs, is around this concept of deadweight loss of taxation or marginal excess burden. So it's an economic concept that essentially penalises some inefficiencies introduced due to taxation. And this is one way where our work departs from the original Productivity Commission's work, because they actually had a mechanism where costs were discounted to 30% of their original value through this economic argument. Whereas we are of the view that the costs kind of represent the services that are provided, and we don't have that discounting that was used in that productivity report. So with that out of the way, we have a couple examples of substitution effects. So in the top row, we had $408 million for younger people in residential aged care. The idea about this is that sometimes young people with disability enter the residential aged care space because there can be a lack of options available elsewhere to provide the support that they need. The NDIS reimburses the Commonwealth Department of Health and Aged Care, or the then department, when this happens. And if we look at the number of people who are under residential aged care prior to the introduction of the NDIS, we find that about 90% of them are eligible, and that's how we end up with 5,400 people. And we've pulled and selected an average kind of cost of that as $75,000. I'll go through another example of people with chronic health conditions. So the background for this is that the NDIS was intended to cover only people with permanent and significant disability, but there are some disputes that broaden access to people with more mild disability, including chronic health conditions, which are often aging-related, like dementia, obesity, arthritis, those kind of things. So in a world without NDIS, most people would receive support from mainstream services like healthcare or aged care, which often attract co-payments or means testing, so a little bit less compared to what is currently being provided through NDIS. So we've carved out a couple cohorts in order to get this estimate. So people with dementia, 4,200, and applied that same average annual residential aged care cost to it, as well as discounting the amount of spending that is currently used for people with physical and mental chronic health conditions. So that gives a flavour of the substitution effects that we have put in place. That's it for me, so I'll pass back to Hugh.
Thanks so much, Jason. So that section really does show that the NDIS has sort of led to a lot more supports being provided to people with disability, both in terms of number of people and the average size for those people as well, which is wonderful. And I think sort of we recognise the transformational effect that that's had for a lot of people. So when we presented this, everyone loved it. Great cost analysis. Well done, Heather Fry. The benefits side proved to be a lot trickier to land for a variety of reasons, but mainly because our bar wasn't big enough. I think one of the reasons why the report was commissioned was, wouldn't it be nice if the benefits were sort of obvious and really large, because then you could say, well, look at all these things that are going well. But what we tended to do is focus on things that we could sort of concretely measure, and that does mean that there are things that are not captured, and we sort of recognise that in the way, hopefully, we presented the results. So our general methodology is incredibly simple. So we define an outcome, so e.g. mortality. We measure it and see if it's improved, yes or no. And then if it has improved, we convert that to an economic benefit. And so our language was dollars. People can get a little bit squeamish about dollars when you apply that to things like mortality or subjective well-being, so we can chat about that in a sec. But sort of in saying all that, we do recognise that gross benefits will be much larger than net benefits. We were looking at that incremental amount. And we do include non-market benefits as part of our analysis, so not just things that save government money, but also sort of the improvements we can see in people's lives. We also had to contend with sort of various arguments about what a benefit is. So not long before our report got commissioned, there was a report out that said the benefits of the NDIS were sort of $2 for every $1 invested. And that particular report, their methodology was, well, every dollar government spends flows to the economy, multiplier effect is about 2, so the benefits are 2-1. And so we didn't do those types of fiscal multiplier arguments. We were actually holding it probably to a higher standard and saying, well, where are the outcomes actually improving? Similarly, we were asked to consider whether the benefits to the disability support sector should be recognised. So the fact that you're paying a lot of people to provide services is growing the economy and that particular sector. Again, we ended up with a report that looked at a higher standard, which was like, does that actually improve the lives of participants and their carers? Which I think, I mean, obviously we're biased, but that we think that's the right way to measure these things. There's also questions around economic utility. So the fact that government spending is going towards more disadvantaged people, utility arguments are important and quite valid. We didn't use one here, but the Productivity Commission report back in 2011, when they set out the case for the NDIS, utility was one thing that they said bared some consideration. Cool. So we had that simple schema, but how do we actually measure outcomes? In our report, we actually took two approaches, and you'll be able to see some of the limitations by hopefully sort of as I talk through them. So we had access to two main data sets. One was data from the NDIA. So there's the short form outcome survey that happens once a year that asks a bunch of questions about people and their outcomes, really quite useful, as well as some administrative data that we sort of laid on top of that. And in doing that, the main challenge is we can't see outcomes for people before they join the scheme because you only sort of do the survey once you join. So what we tried to do instead is basically say, well, at the point of entry into the scheme, let's look at their outcomes and see if their outcomes improve with their time in the scheme, and then build a model to try and estimate how that would look like with the duration affecting the scheme removed. And so that gives you sort of that blue shaded region where the red line is sort of the actuals, and the blue is sort of that hypothetical sort of calculation of what we think it would be without the impact of the scheme. We had a second method as well, which was using HILDA data. So that's a big longitudinal survey of the Australian population. They survey about 15,000 people per year. And in the last few years, they've added an NDIS flag to that. So are you in the NDIS? And there are about 350 people that say yes to that question. which means you can actually ask the longitudinal question for them, have their outcomes improved, and have they improved more than you'd expect compared to other people in that data set. Again, there's sort of comparability challenges. They're smallish numbers, and there's also things you can't see. So you can't see a lot of detailed information about people's disability and their level of function, which reduces your ability to sort of do the type of risk control that we can do on the left-hand side. So that was our basic approach. Well, I'll talk more to the left-hand side, if that makes sense, so using the NDIS data today. In terms of overall benefits, I mentioned the $7.5 billion of benefits that we found. Over 80% of that benefit was what we call non-market benefits, and this was improvements in the subjective well-being of participants and their carers. And we put dollar values on that, and if you are interested in how sort of subjective well-being converts to dollars, definitely ask a question at the end. But it's worth just saying that is a big sort of non-market sort of component of those benefits. So if you don't believe in non-market benefits, then that leaves you with about $1 billion on the left there, which relates to a little bit of employment that we could find, as well as reduced hospitalizations, which is quite a neat result. There's only a few things on that bar. So you might have questions, well, what about everything else? We did test a lot of things, so the blue box on the right there shows some of the other things that we explored. Sometimes we found effects that we decided not to convert into dollars, and usually with good reasons behind it. But in a lot of cases, we couldn't actually see things in the data. And so this was sort of one of those questions where, while the NDIS is recognised as being transformational, it actually suggests that we don't necessarily have all the measures in place to measure some of those transformations in the way we'd like to. If that makes sense. So sort of with those big picture things out of the way, the most interesting things I find in the report are sort of once you drill down into some of those subcategories. So I'll do that quickly, noting that we don't have infinite time to do it. But one of the first questions we looked at was mortality. So do people live longer because they're on the NDIS? And so this slide is just trying to show that mortality is quite heterogeneous and complex. So it varies a lot by age, varies a lot by disability type in terms of the annual mortality. And so there's a lot of sort of risk control that's needed to make that work. I don't think I'll say a huge amount on the specifics there. But we did have to build a risk control model to sort of build mortality. And once we did that, we could basically define a baseline risk using a particular sort of time period and set that to equal to 100. And then ask the question, how does mortality vary over time? And so the blue line is the answer to that question on the left. And the answer is that mortality's gone up rather than down, was what we've sort of found. So that raises some questions and some uncertainties. It's worth saying that the exposure on the very left of that chart is quite low, so there weren't that many people in the scheme in the earliest components. But the line is definitely sort of upish or flattish rather than downish, which means that we didn't bank any mortality benefits in our work. You might be curious about what happens in the Australian population generally if you do the same thing, and that's the dotted red line that we included for comparison. You might see that dotted red line sort of ticks up right at the end of our analysis period, which was 2022, and there's a similar uptick in mortality for people with disability. So we put that down to excess mortality related to COVID. So as you'll remember, a lot of restrictions sort of were phased out in 2022, and there was actually excess mortality across the Australian population. If you've ever wondered what the exact number for excess mortality was for NDIS participants, it's hiding in the report there. It was about 500 or so, which is, I find, quite interesting. So that's the overall trend. There's sort of a related trend, is that can we see something in the duration effects as we model? And the answer is not a lot. And so that's the duration chart on the right-hand side sort of echoes that story, that there's not a huge sort of movement in mortality that we can see sort of through years 1, 2, 3, that there is that interesting uptick between years time zero and time one. We haven't sort of ascribed that value, but that is interesting that there seems to be an increased mortality rates at very early upon entering into the scheme. So that's mortality. Another thing we looked at was health. So in the short form survey, there is a question, how is your physical health on a 5-point scale? And people rate that. And so when we modelled that, you do have to allow for calendar effects and duration effects and year of entry effects. So if you've done reserving in sort of actuarial problems before, you're sort of working across all three dimensions. But when we do that, what we then try and do is isolate the duration effect and sort of say, well, conditional on everything else we know, so people's age, disability type, their level of function, and their reports about their change in physical health, does that go up or down? And so what we actually found, quite interestingly, was that, those reported ratings tended to decrease over time with duration. And so that's the chart there on the left-hand side. In some ways, you'd expect some of that. So for degenerative diseases, MS, for example, you'd expect people's physical ratings to go down. But we actually see that right across the board, pretty much, including disabilities that you wouldn't necessarily sort of class as degenerative. Interestingly, though, we found the opposite results, so a positive result for hospital admissions. So there is a question, how many times have you gone to hospital in the last 12 months? And that number actually does drop with duration when you sort of run it through the model. And so that's quite an interesting result. And if you're particularly optimistic, and I tend to be, that question around previous 12 months is probably one that gives you our window of what happened to people before they entered the scheme. So remember, the first question happens at time zero. So that's a genuine sort of how many times did you go to hospital before you started the NDIS? And interestingly, that's one that did go down. So maybe if you had infinite data and could see people prior to scheme entry, you might see some more positive results coming through. So one of the slightly more controversial bits of the model was around well-being and life satisfaction. And so we constructed a well-being index using a variety of outcomes. We sort of validated it in a couple of ways. It's sort of described in the report. Lots of people hated it, so if you hate it, that's okay. But what we did is tried to scale that so it roughly resembled life satisfaction scores that you typically see. So we had sort of an average of 6.7 and a standard deviation of 1.7. And we can then sort of use that index to track well-being over time. And interestingly, you can see that it decreased if you just look at the raw numbers. And so people tended to answer more negatively. But this is one of the cases where looking at diagonals versus rows versus columns of a triangle gives you slightly different answers. Because if you actually look at people's ratings when they first entered the scheme, they actually dropped massively. So for whatever reason, people who entered later tended to have lower sort of scores on this particular index. And because of that, once you actually control for that and say, well, what can we attribute to the scheme via that duration parameter, life satisfaction actually increases in a material way, so quite statistically significant and quite across the board. And so that's the picture on the right-hand side, so the duration effect. And you can see it sort of kicking in, particularly for years 3, 4, and 5 there. And so that corresponds to about 0.2 life satisfaction points. And that sort of gets converted to dollars for that sort of final analysis. So we didn't just do it this way. We also looked at the life satisfaction score that the NDIA collects on the long form survey. So that's a much longer survey that they run, but on a smaller group of people. I got exactly the same results, which is interesting. And we also ran it on the HILDA data set, got very similar results as well, because that also asks a life satisfaction question. So there's a 5-minute warning. This is where I expected to get to, so that's good. I'll say a couple of words about employment and then I'll stop for questions. So overall, we found pretty limited impacts on employment and people found this a little bit controversial. It's interesting, if you go back to the productivity report in 2011, they said, well, if we can increase the rates of employment for people with disability, that'll be 100,000 extra jobs, that'll be a big number. It turns out that that's a little bit of a sleight of hand because most of those 100,000 jobs probably don't come from NDIS participants. So there's about 30,000 participants in the scheme who are not working currently who would like a job and are looking for one. And that compares to something like 200,000 in the Disability Employment Service who are generally not NDIS participants. And a lot of them will actually go on to find employment at a faster rate. And so there's sort of a little bit of sleight of hand in that original piece of analysis. What we found was that employment rates are very much driven by the labour market, as you'd expect. So the ups and downs tend to track what's going on in the broader economy. We did the modelling. We found small increases in employment for a few disability types for participants. We actually found slightly more substantial improvements for employment for carers, and so that's a larger component. And that does seem to be some of the storyline that comes through some of the other survey work as well. So I'll leave it there. Thank you so much. It was a great report to work on. We had a lot of help.
Thank you very much, Hugh and Jason. I'll get you to hang up here. If you would like to ask a question at the microphone, you're more than welcome to come up as well, noting we've probably got time for a couple of questions. There's one that's already come through on the app from Laura around whether benefits accrue evenly by cohort. Would there be cohorts where that benefit to cost realisation is higher or lower, and can that be used to target scheme design?
That's a good question, and conveniently leads into a different slide. So the costs and benefits by sort of that combination of disability type and level of function is shown at the top there. You can see that those benefits are pretty evenly distributed, which is a fancy way of saying that life satisfaction was a pretty uniform increase is what we could measure. So for disability types where there's low average spend in the NDIS, like if you're interested in benefit cost ratio, it looks a bit better. But the answer is that because there weren't big fiscal benefits that varied a lot by disability type, it's really just a function of sort of how much you're spending on a category. And you don't necessarily see on the analysis we're able to do greater benefits for those different categories.
Excellent. Thank you. Any other questions from the audience? I have one while we're waiting for some people to jump in. So if there was one area that you could spend more time or if you had more access to data, what would that be?
Thank you. The word linkage appeared on one of the slides, and I think there is quite a lot of value, potential value, if you were to sort of, in an alternate universe, do this over a few years. You would actually start looking at some of that linked data and say, well, do people go to jail less than they used to because of the NDIS? Do people's children interact with the child protection system less than they used to? And I have a suspicion that the answer is yes, but that's the type of thing that you can do quite well with linkage that you're not able to do with the two types of analysis we did on this particular job. So.
Yeah, that's excellent. And those sorts of things will develop over time, those longitudinal benefits, absolutely. Was there an opportunity to conduct analysis by severity category across employment and wellbeing?
Yes. So basically all our models for all our outcomes adjusted for those things. So I didn't really describe the regression models, but basically there was a big regression model with lots of factors that adjusted for those things up and down. And then the effect that we're interested in within each of those models is the duration effect. And so if you interact that duration effect by severity or by disability type, which we tended to do, then that would actually give you the disability group specific results and similarly sort of the level of function specific results. So we did all that testing. It was quite interesting how even some of those results came up. I'm not quite sure I know the implication of what that means. But yes, we definitely did that testing on the way through. So if there were large life satisfaction improvements for the psychosocial group and not for other groups, that would have come through.
Excellent. Well, we've come to the end of our session. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming here to listen to Jason and Hugh. And I'm sure they'll be happy to take more questions in the break. If you have any that are unanswered, please give them a round of applause.
Thanks so much. Yes.